Support for IPR and this podcast comes from Valley View Village, an adult community offering a complete continuum of care, including independent living, assisted living, skilled, and long-term care. Learn more about this community at valleyviewvillage.org.
And we're back with more of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Nearly 200,000 babies each year are born with clubfoot. That's a congenital condition that causes a baby's foot to be deformed in a way that the foot is twisted so that the sole cannot be placed flat on the ground. This Saturday marks World Clubfoot Day, a day to commemorate the birth date of Dr. Ignacio Ponseti, the developer of the gold standard treatment for clubfoot, the Ponseti method. The Ponseti method is nearly 100% effective, and it was developed at the University of Iowa. Dr. Ponseti died in 2009. He first came to the United States and the University of Iowa in 1941. Let's listen back to a conversation I had with Dr. Jose Morquende, Chief Medical Director of the Ponseti International Association. We spoke in 2013 about Ponseti's work. Dr. Morquende first came to the University of Iowa in 1990 as an associate professor, planning to work with Ignacio Ponseti, learning his treatment for clubfoot. Here's Dr. Morquende talking about what exactly clubfoot is and how many children it impacts.
Clubfoot is a deformity that the kids are born with. And the word comes from the deformity because the foot looks like a club. So it's completely twisted in. So in some cases, actually, the sole of the foot can be touching the leg. This is a deformity that happened in about 1 in 1,000 kids. So when you look at the numbers, about 200,000 kids are born in the world. But the numbers are a little bit, it might have some more meaning. You divide that by the time, the hours. So every 3 minutes, there's a kid that is born somewhere in the world with a clubfoot deformity.
Mm-hmm. You identify this, of course, at birth, but can you identify it also in the womb?
Yes. Now with the ultrasounds and the prenatal diagnosis, clubfoot can be identified during pregnancy, usually around 20, 24 weeks.
Mm-hmm. If not treated, what happens with to a child as a child develops with clubfoot?
If treatment is not provided to the child, then when they start walking, they will walk with, instead of with the sole of the foot, they will be walking with the upper part of the foot, with the foot completely twisted. Mm-hmm. And that results in a very difficult walk. And over time, then they start developing calluses and then some scars, and then it becomes painful. And the truth is that this deformity in developing countries, that they don't have access to care as we do in here in the United States, is the number one musculoskeletal disability for these kids.
Mm-hmm. You said how many babies each year are born with it? Nearly 200,000 each year in the world. So if a baby is born with a club foot in the United States, it gets treatment across the board.
We take care usually in the first week of life.
Okay, so tell us about the story of Ignacio Ponseti. You knew him for many years before his death in 2009. He was born in 1914 in Spain, came to the University of Iowa in 1941. Tell us more about his story and how he developed this almost miraculous treatment for club foot.
He was born in Mallorca in Spain, and then has his education, medical school in Barcelona. And he actually finished his medical school just one day before the Spanish Civil War started in 1936. So he joined the army and worked as a captain, as a doctor during the war. One thing that is very important is that he was part of a group that developed the treatment of the wounded in the war, and with the new concepts of wound treatment that we have now, like when you have an accident and you have a fracture that is open. So they were very successful saving limbs and also preventing infections in the wounded. And just remember, 1936, there were no antibiotics. So it was all by taking very good care of the wound and immobilizing the joints. So he worked in this group, and unfortunately he was in the losing side, so he had to go into exile. So he went to France, and after a few months, the government of Mexico accepted the Spanish professionals and gave them a place to work and to live. So he decided to come to Mexico and work as a family doctor in a small little town for about 2 years. During this time, he met a doctor in Mexico, Dr. Farrell, who coincidentally was a fellow here in Iowa back in the 20s with Dr. Steinler, the founder of our department, that is going to be actually next month, the 100th anniversary. And he recommended Dr. Ponseri to come to work with Dr. Steinler. And so he did in 1941.
Okay. So before coming to the University of Iowa, his work in the treatment of clubfoot, had that already started, or did that begin here in Iowa?
It did begin here. So he came and did his residency under Dr. Steinler. And when he finished, Dr. Steinler asked him to evaluate the patients that he had treated for clubfoot since he came in 1913. So these patients were about 20, 23, 25 years of age, and Dr. Steinler used to do the treatment like most people by doing surgery, trying to correct and, you know, cut the ligaments and tendons and put the foot straight. And when Dr. Ponseri did this study, they found that most of these patients were not doing very well. When you do surgery in clubfoot, then there's a scar tissue, and in many cases, the scar tissue doesn't grow as normal tissue, and then the foot becomes very stiff, and it has higher rates of complications and also relapses or recurrence. It comes back, and then you have to do surgery again. And usually, the kids need maybe two or three surgeries by the time they are 14 or 15. So he realized that clubfoot surgery was really not a very good solution for clubfoot. So he started studying, you know, why clubfoot happened, and then how can you, you know, modify the technique, and if he was able to do it with just plaster cast.
And so this is a non-surgical, non-invasive treatment, just with plaster casts.
Yes, it's just your hands and plaster cast, and then you mold the cast, and then you do a little bit of stretching. So you take advantage of how the little joints in the foot moves, and then you apply the cast. And what you do is that every week or so, every 5 to 7 days, you stretch a little bit the foot and then put it in a bird position. And so usually in about a month, 3 to 4 weeks, then you have the foot corrected. So mm-hmm. The foot goes from looking like a club to just a normal foot.
How is this at all painful for the patient?
No, this is very gentle. You just do it very, very carefully. You just take advantage of that wonderful stretchability of babies. Mm-hmm. And if you do it in the right way, then the foot really start going into the right direction. It started as a normal foot, and it just during the process of during pregnancy, and we don't know exactly why this happened, it's most likely a genetic component, then the foot start twisting. The muscles get tight, and they have a tendency to tie up with growth. So when you do the casting, then you just stretch those muscles and tendons, and then the bones fall in place, and then the foot looks normal.
Mm-hmm. This is the standard, the gold standard, as I mentioned, in treating clubfoot worldwide. What's the success rate?
Well, I can tell you that it's not until about 8 or 10 years ago that this became the standard of care. Unfortunately, the orthopedic community worldwide didn't listen to Dr. Ponseri for 40 years. His first patient was treated in 1948, and he published a paper in 1963 describing the technique, but nobody listened to him. So it was not until the 2000s that people came back, and when he came back to work again after retirement, and he wrote his book in 1996, that people realized that this method was really powerful and you can get corrections. In our hand, it's close to 100%. 95 to 100% is very common worldwide.
Mm-hmm. I had the pleasure of meeting Dr. Ponseri when he was alive, and I remember the idea that he has to think of the adults now, the children who became adults who he has treated, who can walk normally. He had thank you pictures all over his office, didn't he? From around the world.
Yeah, from every place. He was a very wonderful person. He was a wonderful human being, and every patient and every family loved him. And the patients that he treated in the 50s, we did a study, 50-year follow-up study. So now they are in 45 to 55.
Yeah.
90% of them had never problems or have no problems, you know, with the feet. So it's not just successful to correct the deformity. Is that it lasts, when it's corrected, it lasts for the life of the patient with no problems in general.
It sounds to me like it's almost akin, you know, when kids get work done on their teeth to help them grow straight, that they grow straight, they don't have any other problems, and their dental work is good to go for the rest of their lives.
It's exactly the same. And actually, for this, it requires a brace to be used at night for, you know, 3 or 4 years, like when you have braces for your teeth. And when you get to 4, 4.5, 5, if the feet are straight, it will be straight for life.
We mentioned earlier in the program that a child born in the United States with club foot is treated and treated effectively and pretty much immediately when that is recognized. How far are we away from that standard, that level of care worldwide? Because that's really what you're striving for, isn't it?
Yes. I think it depends on the country, and it goes a little bit for, you know, where's the development in the country. But I will say that half of the countries in the world, about 100, most kids don't get treatment until they are very late, 3, 4 years. And there's probably millions, 2, 3 million, we don't know for sure, of adults that had never been treated. So we have a lot of work to do, but we hope that in the next maybe 10 years, 15 years, we implement systems in each country so the kids are identified early. And you will be discussing here later the maternal health and neonatal issues. So in every country, the kids are identified early, are referred to centers where the Ponseti method is practiced. So there's not going to be any more disability in the future.
We can look forward to that day. Thanks to you, Dr. Jose Morquende, and first and foremost to the work of Ignacio Ponseti at the University of Iowa. Thank you for coming into our studio today, Doctor.
Thank you.
You've been listening to my conversation on the origins of the Ponseti method, the nearly 100% effective treatment for clubfoot developed at the University of Iowa. This Saturday marks World Clubfoot Day. It's a day to commemorate the birth date of Dr. Ignacio Ponseti, the developer of the Ponseti method. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Let's shift gears a bit and talk about NASA's Cassini spacecraft, currently monitoring Saturn and its rings. This Sunday, Cassini made its most dangerous plunge close to the planet, collecting spectacular views of Saturn's rings with an onboard camera. The images collected by Cassini show new close-up angles of the structure of Saturn's rings. Cassini is in its final phases of its 20-year voyage, and scientists at the University of Iowa designed and built an instrument aboard the Cassini spacecraft. Let's listen back to my conversation from last December with Bill Kurth. He's a research scientist in the Department of Physics and Astronomy at the University of Iowa. Here's a conversation we had about the University of Iowa's involvement in NASA's mission to Saturn. I began our conversation by asking him to take us back to the origins of the Cassini mission.
Cassini is kind of a veteran. It arrived in orbit at Saturn in 2004, in the summer, and that was after about a 7-year journey from the Earth. It takes a long time to get that far from the Earth. So we've been in orbit for almost 13 years. And the mission will come to a very definitive end on September 15th when we put the spacecraft into Saturn's atmosphere.
Mm-hmm. Now, it will crash in, it'll burn up in the atmosphere.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Well, why do you choose to do that, or is there no choice here?
Well, we don't really have a choice. NASA has an Office of Planetary Protection, which tells us that we have to do this. And the primary reason that we have to do this is there are icy moons in the Saturnian system, Enceladus being the primary one, where Cassini has discovered that there are active geysers going on. They're spewing out water and ice. And we now believe that there is liquid water beneath the icy crust of Enceladus. And those who would like to go elsewhere in the solar system to find out if life originated someplace other than Earth, they think about places that have liquid water because, as we all know, liquid water is very important for at least the life that we understand. So if you can imagine going there in 10 or 20 or 30 years with a spacecraft that's designed to look for life at Enceladus, if Cassini would have, by accident or by design, crashed into Enceladus, and we found life 20 or 30 years later, how would we answer the question of whether some microbe happened to survive its journey on Cassini and the crash on Enceladus, and then was the source for life that was eventually found at Enceladus, if that's the case? Mm-hmm. So we basically want to make sure that places like Enceladus are pristine, so that when we do go and look for evidence for life, we can rule out the possibility that that life came from Earth.
On Cassini, what is your involvement with Cassini?
Well, I'm the principal investigator for the radio and plasma wave science instrument. And as Jasper has mentioned, we're kind of the ears of the spacecraft. We listened for naturally occurring radio waves from frequencies as low as 2 hertz, that's below the audio frequency range, to frequencies as high as 16 megahertz. And just as an example, one of the things that we've been studying at Saturn is the occurrence of thunderstorms. Actually, it was a University of Iowa instrument on the Voyager 1 spacecraft that discovered that there was also lightning at Jupiter. We detected a type of radio emission from those from lightning strokes at Jupiter. About the same time, the camera on Voyager took a picture of the backside, the dark side of Jupiter, and noticed clouds that were being illuminated from below by lightning flashes. So up until 1979, Earth was the only planet that we knew that had lightning.
Okay. And so we have a little bit of audio to go along with this. This is on Saturn, I believe. You know this audio provided to us. Well, what will we hear here in just a moment?
Well, I think most of your listeners have probably tried to listen to the Cubs during a thunderstorm in the middle of the summer on AM radio, and have been frustrated by a nearby thunderstorm that provides what most of us talk about as static. Mm-hmm. But all that noise that's interfering with what they're trying to listen to are actually radio emissions from the lightning strokes themselves. In addition to producing the light that we see as flashes, a broad spectrum of electromagnetic energy, including radio waves going down to just a few kilohertz, is emitted with each lightning stroke. At Saturn, we're seeing the very high frequency end of that spectrum when there's lightning in thunderstorms at Saturn. And these, again, were discovered by the Voyager spacecraft when it flew by in the early 1980s. But Cassini has been in orbit for over 10 years now and has been able to study the occurrence of thunderstorms in Saturn. And it's quite interesting. We typically only see one or two storms at Saturn at a time, and there may be months in between when there's absolutely no lightning going on. And in late 2010, we detected the beginning of a storm which eventually encircled the entire planet and was producing lightning at the rate of 10 strokes per second, which is about the fastest that we could count. And this produced what astronomers had noticed in previous years as a great white storm. One of these storms occurs about once every Saturn year, and on Saturn it takes 29 years to go around the sun.
Wow. And so, you said this storm stretched around the entire planet.
Right.
Okay, so the sound we're going to hear is what?
Okay, the sound you're going to hear are actual measurements from our instrument on Cassini. Now, we've sped up the time. This is actually, these data were taken over a two-hour time period, I believe. But I think you'll hear the similarity between what you hear on your AM radio in the middle of a thunderstorm and what Cassini detects from Saturn's lightning.
Okay, this is an audio representation of what lightning sounds like on Saturn.
Thank you.
Okay, there you have it, about 2 hours condensed into 20 seconds. What is the significance of discovering that and discovering that thunderstorms happen on Saturn?
Well, I think part of all of planetary science is going to other planets and finding out what phenomena are common amongst the planets and which ones are not. I think we learn an awful lot about our own weather and our own climate by going to other planets that have that are further from the sun, that have shorter days, that have very thick atmospheres, to find out, you know, do the same physics apply at Saturn as applies in our own atmosphere. And this is just one aspect of the type of broadening of our knowledge of our own situation by going elsewhere and finding out, well, you know, are we the only ones that have lightning? No, we are definitely not the only ones that have lightning. It looks like it's a very common phenomenon, at least in the solar system.
A conversation I had last December with Bill Kurth, research scientist in the Department of Physics and Astronomy at the University of Iowa, talking about the University of Iowa's involvement in NASA's mission to Saturn. The Cassini spacecraft is currently monitoring Saturn and its rings. This past Sunday, Cassini made its most dangerous plunge close to the planet. It collected spectacular views of Saturn's rings with an onboard camera. The images collected by Cassini show new close-up angles of the structure of Saturn's rings. Cassini is in its final phases of its 20-year voyage. And we're in the final phases of this hour's program, produced by Emily Woodbury, Lindsay Moon, and Ben Stanton, with help from Robbie Broad. Our executive producer is Catherine Perkins. River to River is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us.